Latins, adiuva nos. I go overseas to give help. He removed the sign from the attic and hung it in his entry hall so he could read it each time he came or went. Stepping inside, he told Carlton to help himself to whatever he could find in the kitchen and that he would join him there in a few minutes. He turned and walked down the opposite hall to his study. Once he got there, he stood looking at the shelves and shelves of books. Everything was in perfect alphabetical order by author. When he had first moved in, he thought that was the best way to organize his vast library. Only now did he wish he had grouped things by subject matter. One of Harvath's passions was American history, particularly the years surrounding the Revolutionary War. He had loved that piece of America's past since he was a boy. In fact, had his two majors in college not kept him so busy, he might have considered adding an American history minor. It took him a few minutes to find what he was looking for, but once he had all the books stacked on his desk, he picked them up and headed for the kitchen. Carlton had found probably the only two food items in the entire house that seemed to weather Harvath's long trips away without spoiling: pickled herring and Wasa crisp bread, yet another throwback to his Scandinavian-themed dating days. Setting the books on the kitchen table, Harvath grabbed a beer from the fridge and joined the old man.
"What's all this?" Carlton asked.
"Research," replied Harvath,
as he twisted the top off his beer and sent the cap sailing toward the sink.
"Books? Why don't you use the internet like everyone else?"
He shook his head. It was ironic that he'd be the one championing books while the old man touted the internet.
"The web's pretty good, but it doesn't have everything. When it comes to historical items, books are still the best bet."
Harvath opened the uppermost book from his stack and began leafing through it. When he figured out that it wasn't the one he wanted, he set it aside and opened another. Soon enough, he came to the page he was looking for.
"Let me see the tight shot of the sign hung around Claire Marcourt's neck," he said, without taking his eyes from the book.
Opening the folder on the table, Reed Carlton fished out the picture and handed it to Harvath.
"Here you go."
"Thanks," Harvath replied, as he took it and set it inside, right next to the image he was looking at.
He then turned the book so the old man could see.
"They're almost a perfect match,"
Harvath nodded.
"Except Claire Marcourt's doesn't have the words death to tyranny underneath."
"Which would have been redundant, considering the line from Jefferson."
"I agree. That's probably why they left it out."
Carlton stared at the image.
"That's been bothering me ever since we saw it at the Fed. I know I should remember that crown over the skull and bones, but I don't."
The man was a walking encyclopedia about almost everything. It wasn't often that Harvath knew something that Carlton didn't, and when that happened, he often ribbed the older man over it. Carlton may have been his boss, but he had grown to be like a second father to him. Harvath's own father had died not long after he had graduated from high school. The two hadn't been on good terms. Harvath's father, also a U.S. Navy SEAL, had been against Scott's pursuing a career in professional sports, despite his son's success on the competition circuit and acceptance to the U.S. ski team. Like father, like son, Harvath had been bound and determined to do what he wanted to do. Ignoring his father's wishes, he pursued his athletic career, and their relationship suffered dramatically because of it. They fell into a cold silence, with Harvath's mother doing everything she could to keep the family together. The frosty detente collapsed when Harvath's father was killed in a training accident. Harvath's athletic career collapsed soon after. No matter how hard he tried, he couldn't get his head back into competition. The crushing guilt was more than he could bear. He knew he had let his father down. No matter how many friends and coaches spoke to him, his mind couldn't be changed. He abandoned sports and decided to return to school. After graduating cum laude from the University of Southern California, he joined the Navy and was eventually accepted into BUDS. It was the most grueling experience Harvath had ever undergone, but the idea that if his father could do it, he could do it, propelled him forward. His athletic prowess and ironclad determination saw him excel. He graduated at the top of his class and was assigned to SEAL Team 2, also known as the Polar Seals, where his proficiency in skiing was an exceptional asset. As much as he enjoyed his Team 2 colleagues, he wasn't seeing enough action with them to keep him happy, and so he applied for the storied SEAL Team 6. Harvath had built a bit of a rep for himself, but even so, SEAL Team 6 was very, very particular about who they allowed to join their ranks. As much as the rest of the SEAL community was loath to admit it, SEAL Team 6 was in a class all its own. It was one of the most elite organizations in the world, and one of the most difficult to be accepted into. You had to prove you not only deserved to be there, but also wanted it more than anything else. The members of SEAL 6 didn't make it easy. In fact, they did everything they could to discourage Harvath. None of it worked. In the middle of an endurance exercise designed so that there was no way anyone could complete it, they realized he was either going to join their ranks or die trying, and they ended the audition. Scott Harvath had won his probationary place among their ranks. Language proficiency was not something SEALs were particularly known for, but Harvath's aptitude was quickly recognized and encouraged. He was sent to school for any language he showed talent for or interest in, including Arabic and Russian. His skill at SEAL Team 6 won the attention of the Secret Service, who recruited him to the White House to help bolster their anti- and counterterrorism expertise. From there, the president at the time realized Harvath had a special set of skills that could better serve the nation in an offensive capacity. That was how Harvath wound up with a top-secret program hidden away at the Department of Homeland Security. It was one of the most forward-thinking and aggressive projects the United States had ever come up with. As long as the terrorist refused to play by any rules, Harvath wasn't expected to either. He was set loose upon them without mercy. When the administration changed, Harvath's program was discontinued and he was let go. That's when the old man had picked him up and had taken his training to an entirely new level. The career intelligence officer had taught Harvath everything he knew. Then he sent Harvath out to train with the best shooters, hand-to-hand combat instructors, interrogators, and former spies, among other dark arts specialists. By the time Harvath was done, he was one of the most formidable counterterrorism and intelligence operatives to ever ply the trade. In short, he was an apex predator, an animal at the top of the food chain who hunted, yet was so fearsome, he himself was not hunted. Be that as it may, Harvath had spent the last couple of years in awe of the old man. No matter how much he had seen and done in his career, he felt he would never accomplish as much as what Carlton had done.
"So, are you going to keep me in suspense, or are you going to tell me what we're looking at?" the old man asked.
Harvath smiled.
"What's so funny?" Carlton said.
"I just figured at a prestigious university like Brown with a catch-all major like Western Civilization, you would have learned at least a little about the Stamp Act."
Chapter 12.
The Stamp Act was a tax on any piece of paper printed in the colonies. Newspapers, licenses, legal documents, anything and everything. Even playing cards. The Brits claimed it was necessary in order to pay for the thousands of troops it had protecting the colony's back door near the Appalachian Mountains. The colonists, though, had a greater fear than invaders from the frontier. They were afraid that if this tax was allowed to pass unchallenged, there'd be a tidal wave of taxes to follow, and all without any colonial input, said Harvath.
"Taxation without representation," replied the old man.
"Precisely. In an act of defiance, the colonists refused it. Instead, they began drawing their own stamp on their printed materials. They used a skull and crossbones, and eventually some added a crown floating above it to represent tyrannical Britain."
"Death to tyranny."
Harvath nodded.
"What do you think the SOL stands for? Is it Latin or something?"
"I don't think so," he said, reaching for another book and flipping through its pages. "I think it has to do with the bloody streaks left on the sign by Claire Marcourt's fingers."
"Why do you think those two are connected? Maybe she grasped at the sign in her death throes."
It doesn't make any sense to hang a sign around someone's neck until they're dead, Harbath replied. Why go to all the trouble of the sign just to have the victim mess it up? If you're going to kill somebody, you kill them and then hang it around their neck.
So the bloody streaks were put there on purpose? Just like the logs the body was put on?
If I can find the right picture, I'll show you, and then you tell me what you think.
The old man waited while Harbath flipped through two more books until he found it. When he did, he placed the police photo of the sign that had been hung around Marquardt's neck beneath the image of a flag in his new book and spun them around to show him. What am I looking at here? The old man asked.
A flag with 9 vertical stripes, 5 red and 4 white, responded Harbath, as he splayed the fingers of his right hand, placed them on the table, and slowly drew them toward himself like Claire Marquardt's bloody fingers sliding down the sign.
You think that woman's bloody finger streaks look like that flag?
I don't know. You tell me.
Carlton studied both pictures for a few moments. The irritation was back in his voice again.
I think it's a stretch.
Fair enough, said Harbath,
as he removed the police photo in order to reveal the caption beneath the flag.
How about now?
The old man leaned forward and peered at the writing.
Hold on, he said, pulling his glasses from his suit pocket and putting them on. The caption says this is the flag of the Sons of Liberty?
A fraction of a second later, he put it together.
Sons of Liberty. S-O-L.
Harbath sat back and took a long, satisfied sip of his beer.
Who are they?
They were America's first organized resistance, he said. A group of patriots, inspired by what they saw as the tyranny of the Stamp Act, who banded together to fight British oppression. Their most famous operation was one of my favorites, the Boston Tea Party.
The old spymaster sat for a moment, appreciating one of America's greatest historical moments, and then replied,
You think whoever's behind all of this is styling themselves as some sort of modern Sons of Liberty movement?
I do, said Harbath, as he reached for his last book and opened it. Ever heard of the Pine Tree Riot?
Carlton shook his head.
One of the reasons the Brits were the most powerful empire in the world was because of their command of the high seas, via both their navy and their merchant vessels. They were building ships at an incredible clip, and white pine trees were considered the best species from which to make soaring single-stick masts. Because the British Isles had been stripped almost entirely clean of white pines, they passed a law in the colonies that made it illegal to cut down any white pine here more than 12 inches in diameter. This angered lots of colonial loggers, builders, and sawmill owners. Many of them just ignored the law. In fact, it became highly fashionable among the colonists to thumb their noses at Britain by installing floors made of white pine and showing off that their boards were at least a foot wide or wider.
What does that have to do with the logs Claire Marquardt was found on?
Harbath pointed to the photo and the thickest log in the stack.
See the arrow chalked on this one?
The old man peered at it and nodded as Harbath paraphrased the accompanying text.
When the Crown sent its surveyors of the King's Woods on inspections, any trees found to have been cut down in violation of the edict were marked with a big, thick arrow, just like in that photo. Anyone found to be in possession of white pines, considered property of the Crown, was heavily fined. In 1772, a surveyor for the Crown uncovered a mill owner in Ware, New Hampshire, named Ebenezer Mudgett, who had been cutting down white pines that should have been reserved for the king. Mudgett was fined, but he refused to pay, so the county sheriff, along with his deputy, rode out and arrested him. Mudgett must have been a hell of a salesman because he convinced the sheriff to release him that night with the promise that he'd show up in the morning to pay his bail.
He didn't show up, did he? Said Carlton with a laugh.
No, he showed up all right, Harbath replied, but was somewhere between 20 to 40 men. They arrived, their faces blackened with soot, just before dawn at Quimby's Inn, where the sheriff and his deputy were staying.
I assume it didn't end well. What happened?
They beat the sheriff and his deputy with tree switches and then shaved the manes of their horses. And here's the kicker. They cut off the horse's ears to send a message and make them worthless.
The old man screwed his face up in disgust.
That's horrible.
I agree 100%.
Were they ever caught?
You bet, said Harbath. And they were all prosecuted, but they only received a small fine. And because the punishment was so lenient, some think it encouraged more resistance and actually set the stage for the Boston Tea Party less than 2 years later.
So again, the message this group is sending now is what? That the Federal Reserve is a tyrant like King George and they're going to handle it by kidnapping and murdering people until it is shut down?
Or until they're caught. But I think I may have an idea as to how we can catch them.
Chapter 13. York County, Virginia. Lydia Ryan remembered the first time she had ever seen Camp Perry, the 9,000-acre military base near Williamsburg, Virginia, referred to by CIA personnel as the Farm. She, along with 12 other recruits, had been transported there on a crisp fall morning in a white passenger van with blacked-out windows to begin their CIA training. Out of those 12, only 5 would make it all the way through. Much of the curriculum harkened back to the heyday of the CIA's predecessor, the Office of Strategic Services, or OSS, and was heavy with paramilitary instruction. From weapons and explosives to parachuting and land navigation, there were times when the recruits questioned whether they had signed up for a career in intelligence or the military. The tradecraft, which would form the bulk of what they'd be learning, wouldn't come till later. The first month at the farm was all about what the recruits were made of and how badly they wanted to be there. It was a particularly sadistic version of boot camp and involved nothing but physical conditioning and hand-to-hand combat. Every exercise, whether it was a run, a timed rucksack march, accelerated PT, or even the obstacle course, was designed to get as many students to drop out as possible. Instructors yelled, berated, and constantly got right up into their charges' faces, telling them that they didn't belong at the agency and should aim for something easier, like the FBI. In preparation for the year-long basic operations course, Ryan had searched for any information she could find on what to expect and how to make it through. There was next to nothing available, so she read a stack of books on the rigorous selection processes for the Navy SEALs, the Army Special Forces, and the British SAS. What she learned was that they were all very similar. The idea was to stress trainees to such a degree that no matter what they encountered in the real world, they'd be able to adapt and overcome. While the SEAL, Green Beret, SAS soldier, or CIA operative unquestionably plied a physical trade, success or failure would always come down to their mental mettle. If you steadfastly refused to quit, you rapidly narrowed your options to only winning. That was the type of personality a sovereign nation could put millions of training dollars into and then drop into the field, confident that those operatives would see their assignment through. Ryan's intelligence, determination, and physical abilities were quickly realized. Her beauty was simply icing on the cake. Even without makeup, she was a striking woman, not someone who naturally blended in and was easily forgotten. That fact, though, could be dealt with. Ryan could be taught how to mask her good looks. On the other hand, taking a less appealing woman and trying to make her as attractive as Ryan was next to impossible without plastic surgery. There was also an intangible aura about her, a magnetism that couldn't be taught. In short, she was a one-in-a-million recruit, whose gifts weren't fully apparent until she began the basic operations course. Once her talents were on display, it was up to one man to make sure they were noted and leveraged to their maximum potential. It was that man that Ryan had now returned to the farm to see. In addition to being a lead instructor for the basic operations course, Bob McGee was also a spotter. Before she arrived, he had read Ryan's file cover to cover, just as he did the files of every other recruit being considered for eventual placement in the CIA's National Clandestine Service. The NCS, was charged with a myriad of missions, including the collection of foreign intelligence and the development of clandestine human intelligence assets. But it was the planning and execution of covert operations that most interested McGee. A former Delta Force operative who had joined the CIA after leaving the Army, McGee was tasked with flagging prospective candidates for a secretive branch of the clandestine service called the Special Activities Division, or SAD. Based on her jacket, Ryan had looked pretty good on paper, but it wasn't until he saw her in action that he appreciated how good she really was. There was no way, though, that he was going to put his stamp of approval on her without making sure she was completely up to the task. So, he had made it his personal mission to push her harder than all the others. As recruits were prohibited from sharing personal information with each other, they were left with little to talk about other than their training. McGee's treatment of Ryan quickly became the hottest topic of conversation in the short window they had for R&R each night. Most of the students believed McGee was a woman-hater. The prevailing wisdom was that somewhere in his past, some woman had crushed him so badly that he now reveled in torturing female recruits. Ryan was an obvious choice, as she was the best-looking in class, and either reminded McGee of the woman who had jilted him, or she somehow made him feel inferior. A couple of other recruits, one an undergrad psychology major, had a different take and likened McGee's behavior to that of kindergarten boys who pull the hair of the girls they secretly like. None of them, though, suspected that Ryan was being tested for something bigger than a junior NCS officer, not even after she was removed from their ranks and the basic operations course altogether. She was moved into the CIA's Special Activities Division, which handled tactical paramilitary operations and covert political action, as well as destabilization efforts, psychological and economic warfare. While the paramilitary side of SAD drew primarily from Tier 1 operators, such as the SEALs and Delta, there was a tremendous amount of danger on the political action side, and its members needed to be highly skilled. Once McGee was convinced that Ryan had the right stuff for SAD, he had her approved and transferred into a tailored training program which he personally oversaw. As such, he became her mentor at the agency, and the person she had always been able to count on for good advice, as well as less-than-stellar career counseling. During her problems with Phil Durkin, it had been McGee who suggested saving a lot of time and trouble by just putting a bullet in his head and dumping him in a quarry somewhere. Ryan didn't doubt for a moment that McGee was serious. He had never liked Durkin, and he liked him even less for preying on his star student. In fact, though she couldn't prove it, Ryan suspected that it was McGee who had made Durkin's wife, Brenda, aware of her husband's sordid advances. Stopping now, just outside her mentor's office, Ryan raised her hand to knock on the door, when McGee's voice boomed from the other side. "It's open!" Chapter 14. Bob McGee was a tall man in his late 50s, who ran 4 days a week and spent the other three in the gym. He sported a thick mustache, which, like his wavy hair, had somehow managed to escape the ravages of time. There were some who said that the only thing stronger than the forces of aging was McGee's vanity, along with a bottle of hair color he kept hidden away somewhere. When the door opened, he looked up from his desk and saw Lydia Ryan standing in his doorway. "So, this is how it ends," he said with a smile. "Well, at least they didn't send a stranger. I don't suppose it would make any difference if I offered you half the money, would it?" Ryan shook her head and smiled back. "You should have disappeared when you had the chance, Bob." "And give up all of this?" he asked, sweeping his arms out and taking in his tiny office. "Not a chance." She laughed, and they met in the center of the room where he gave her a big hug. Once they were done saying hello, he offered her one of the chairs in front of his desk while he took the other. "What's so top secret that we couldn't discuss it over a secure phone? This isn't about that jackass Durkin again, is it? I told you, you should have shot him and dumped him in a shallow grave."
"Technically, you said I should have dumped him in a quarry."
McGee grinned. "Even better. No, wait. Shoot him,
plant pocket litter on him from a gay bar, and then dump him. The agency hates that kind of stuff. Would never dig too deep. You'd get off scot-free.
Pocket litter. Check. If and when I shoot him, I'll remember that.
So, what's Durkin done now?
Ryan took a deep breath. I don't know that he's done anything.
Then what's the problem?
How much time do you have?
McGee leaned back in his chair, put his hands behind his head, and made himself comfortable. As much time as you need. After recounting everything to McGee and sharing with him the materials Nafi Naziri had given her in Frankfurt, she waited for her mentor to respond with something insightful that would help her figure out a way forward. What a friggin' disaster, he finally said.
That's it? That's all you've got to say?
What do you want me to say?
I want you to make some sort of suggestion about how we're going to handle this.
McGee sat forward in his chair. We? Why is this suddenly my problem?
Damn it, Bob. I need your help. This is serious.
I'll make it easy for you. I think your pal at Jordanian Intelligence is pulling your chain. There's no way they'd play chicken with a potential terrorist attack. Not a chance in hell.
So you think he's making it up? Said Ryan.
I think everybody's making things up.
You mean Durkin?
McGee nodded. Your D-Stabe team was top-notch, but they broke the cardinal rule. They got caught.
But they all got canned.
No way, he replied. They may have been scrubbed from the rolls, but there's no way Durkin let those guys go. They were too good. From what I heard, they had multiple reprimands. You were considered a by-the-book player, and attaching you to that team was a last-ditch effort to rein them in. When things went south, they were shut down. McGee made air quotes as he said the words, shut down.
But Durkin told me to my face that he has no idea what they're up to or where they are.
Come on, Ryan. Don't be so naive. He's a spook, just like you. He's paid to lie to people.
McGee was right. I don't get it. We're just supposed to ignore potentially actionable intel from the Jordanians?
How well do you know Naziri?
Very well. He took a shoulder full of shrapnel for me. Probably saved my life, she replied.
And you trust him?
I wouldn't be wasting my time or yours if I didn't. Listen, I agree. I think holding back information on a terrorism plot is particularly bad form for an ally. But if our positions were reversed, I'd do the exact same thing. In fact, I'd probably do more.
McGee flipped slowly through the material again as he spoke. If this is legitimate, it's pretty damning, regardless of whether or not your old team is still working for Durkin. If it can be proven that the United States not only cooked up and carried out the Arab Spring, but is continuing to topple governments throughout the Middle East, that's going to cause an international firestorm. It'll sink this administration.
I don't care about the political ramifications. What I care about is stopping a terrorist attack from being carried out on U.S. soil. We're not going to get any help from the Jordanians without giving them something in return.
Why not take this to someone above Durkin?
You don't think I already thought of that? What if I'm wrong? What if the Jordanians are playing me? I'll look like a fool. Worse, I could end up looking like I cooked this whole thing up just to embarrass Durkin.
McGee shook his head. You can't go tearing after this without some sort of approval. You have to get someone to sprinkle holy water on it.
And who's going to do that?
He tapped the folder against his knee as he ran the possibilities through his mind. What if I could get you into the director's office? Ryan laughed.
Who do you think I was contemplating going over Durkin's head to? The DCI's a tyrant. He hates when the chain of command isn't followed. He'll just kick it back to Durkin and pin a pink slip to my back with a knife.
I'm not talking about the director of Central Intelligence. I'm talking about the other director, the DCI's boss.
The director of National Intelligence?
McGee nodded.
How do you have that kind of pull? She asked.
I'm an important guy. Ryan laughed again.
Yeah, right.
Your lack of faith aside, if I can make a meeting with the DNI happen, are you interested?
What makes you think he won't kick it back to our director, who'll then fire me for violating the chain of command?
Because I'll protect you.
Protect me how? Asked Ryan.
The DNI and I go back a long way, and he owes me some favors. I'll make sure you've got cover.
If you can guarantee cover, I'm in.
As McGee leaned over his desk to reach for the phone, he shooed Ryan out of his office.
Give me 20 minutes.
Nodding, she stepped out into the hall. Coming to see McGee had been the right thing to do. She had felt it even before walking into his office. The only problem was that walking out of his office, she was now feeling something else, and it troubled her more than the prospect of being chewed out for violating the CIA chain of command or even being fired. She was gripped by the fear that no matter what strings her mentor might pull, it wouldn't matter, because they were already too far behind to catch up. Chapter 15. Washington, District of Columbia. Harvath pulled up in front of the chipped brick warehouse and checked the rusted numbers above the door against the address the old man had given him. He appeared to be at the right place. Though he normally didn't leave anything of value in his SUV, he did a quick visual sweep of the seats just to make sure. This neighborhood wasn't exactly in the town's garden district, and the last thing he wanted to do was tempt some passing thug into a quick smash and grab. Preparing to exit the vehicle, he adjusted his weapon. He was convinced that one of the biggest reasons D.C. was so dangerous was that its citizens weren't allowed to defend themselves and legally carry firearms. The criminals knew this and took full advantage. A proponent of the belief that it was better to be judged by 12 than carried by 6, Harvath always carried his .45 caliber H&K USP Compact in a custom Blackhawk Check 6 holster, placed securely behind his right hip, wherever he was. One of the few exceptions was that afternoon, when he had gone straight from the airport to the Federal Reserve Building. As a rule, any weapons used overseas stayed overseas. By and large, most of the rules Harvath lived by served him well. Some, though, were more difficult to reconcile with circumstances than others. His maxim that there was no such thing as a perfect crime was a prime example. Whether it was a terrorist attack, a kidnapping, or a murder, there were always clues to be found. But in the case of the kidnapped Fed candidates, the clues were proving to be extremely hard to find. With some help from the old man, Harvath had turned his study into a makeshift war room, and they officially launched their investigation. They began with what Harvath had hoped would be the easiest and quickest route to uncovering potential suspects, the Internet. Though he didn't know much about the Fed, he did know that their critics were fairly outspoken. Some of the better-known ran the gamut from pundits to business leaders and members of Congress, while the lesser-known were simply day-to-day citizens. He used every mix of search terms he could come up with. He began with a generic search for the Sons of Liberty, and because of its historical relevance, was gifted with over 1 million prospective returns. He tried to narrow it down by adding the term Federal Reserve to the search, and ended up with just over 13,000 possibilities. From there, he added the names of the kidnapped candidates and hit a digital wall. As best he could tell, none of the terms appeared together, at least not openly anywhere on the web. Stripping out the Sons of Liberty from his search, he entered the hostages' names along with the term Federal Reserve. He even tried adding the Henry Hazlitt quote about today being the tomorrow that the bad economist told us to ignore. The results were a mixed bag and not very helpful. There wasn't anyone, at least not on the open internet, calling for any of the victims to be harmed, much less killed. Harvath turned his attention to the police reports. He had been through Claire Marcourt's file 100 times. It felt like there was something missing, but he just couldn't put his finger on it. He read through the reports of the other kidnapped victims, searching for some common thread, but the only thing he seemed to be able to come up with was that the kidnappings had been very well executed. They had all happened on the same night, but in different cities, which meant that multiple teams had to have been used. That was a plus as far as Harbath was concerned. The more people involved in any plot, the greater the chances were that one of them would screw up. The challenge, though, was allocating enough assets to a case in order to see the screw-up the moment it happened, jump on it, and leverage it to your advantage. The Carlton Group, though, didn't have many assets, much less extra ones they could move from project to project, as they'd been forced to let most of their people go. At the moment, Harbath was it, conducting the entire investigation himself out of his house, with his study acting as ground zero, and the overflow spilling into the hall. Even the old man was limited by how much time he could spare. He had spent a few hours with Harbath on the assignment before having to leave to deal with the fallout from the Sienna Star operation. Though he didn't come right out and say it, Carlton had also been troubled by Claire Marquardt's murder. Harbath could see it in his face, and by how much time he had spent with the file. He'd scanned all the contents onto his laptop and uploaded them onto a secure FTP site before walking outside to place a lengthy phone call. When he came back in and announced that he was leaving, he handed Harbath a slip of paper with the address for a warehouse and WW2 written on it. The initials stood for William Wise II.
"He's expecting you," the old man had said on his way out the door.
"Expecting me for what? Who is he?"
"He used to work for the agency. Brilliant guy. Knows something about everything. I gave him the file. He might have some insight."
Harbath tried to ask what kind of work Wise had done and what made him so special, but Carlton was in a hurry and gone before the conversation could go any further. He figured he'd learn soon enough. Walking up to the front of the building, Harbath noticed several low-visibility security precautions. While they may have been in response to the neighborhood's crime rate, Harbath suspected there might be another, much more realistic reason. Whoever this Bill Wise person was, he had some very dangerous enemies. Chapter 16. Bill Wise looked like Santa Claus, crossed with one of the toughest bikers the Hell's Angels had ever produced. He had white hair, a thick white beard, and towered over Harbath by a good 5 inches and an additional 75 pounds. He wore dark jeans, a pair of black Fry boots, and a faded Dallas Cowboys jersey. On his right wrist was a copper bracelet, the kind used for warding off arthritis, and on his left was an expensive Panerai diver's watch. As Harbath stepped inside, Wise stole a quick glance toward the street, closed the door, and then offered his hand.
"Thanks for seeing me on such short notice, Mr. Wise."
"First of all, it's Dr. Wise, and second of all, give me a break with all the formalities," he replied with a smile. "If Peaches says you're okay, then that's good enough for me."
Peaches was the nickname the old man had been known by back in the day. According to legend, he was one of the roughest interrogators the Central Intelligence Agency had ever produced. He had a reputation for taking the hardest cases, the worst of the worst, and could be absolutely brutal with the enemy. It was said that if lives hung in the balance and time was of the essence, Reed Carlton was the man you wanted on the job. The fact that he was willing to go to some pretty extraordinary lengths in his interrogations had earned him the amusing and also chilling sobriquet of Peaches. He was anything but sweet. Signaling for Harbath to follow, Wise led him into the warehouse. They passed through a small reception area, its walls covered with pictures. In addition to noticing that Wise had traveled the world, often heavily armed and in the presence of indigenous fighters, he discerned that the man was a scuba diver, private pilot, Eagle Scout, photographer, motorcyclist, NASCAR and IndyCar fan, and a hunter with a ranch in San Saba County, Texas.
"Do you hunt?" Wise asked, after noticing Harbath admiring his ranch photos.
"Strictly bipeds these days."
Wise chuckled and led him through a heavy sliding door into the main section of the building. It was a large, loft-like space, with thick metal trusses and a pristine epoxy-coated concrete floor. Parked near a wide roll-up door was a trio of perfectly restored vintage SUVs, a green 1960s Land Rover, a metallic gray 1970s International Harvester Scout, and a white 1980s Jeep Grand Wagoneer with wood paneling. Beyond them were a handful of older motorcycles in varying states of refurbishment. Harvath could make out a Triumph Bonneville, as well as an Indian, and what looked like a Crocker.
"Are you the force behind all of these restorations?" Harvath asked.
"I am," Wise replied. "Ever since I was a kid, I've loved taking things apart and putting them back together."
As Harvath admired the machines, the man added, "Don't ever retire. You'd be surprised how expensive puttering turns out to be." This time, Harvath chuckled. He still had no idea what Wise had done for a living, but if he was like any of the other retired spooks he'd met in his lifetime, Wise had probably done his share of consulting after leaving the agency and had made quite a few bucks doing it. The garage portion of the warehouse ended at an enormous floor-to-ceiling glass display case. Inside was row after row of vintage typewriters and antique sewing machines. The display delineated the beginning of Wise's living area. There was a stainless steel kitchen, a massive library with columns of 12-foot-high bookshelves that went all the way to the structure's rear wall, and a giant drafting table that served as the man's desk. Hanging on the wall near it were a myriad of degrees, one of them a PhD in psychology, as well as several diplomas and commendations from the Army's 75th Ranger Regiment and 5th Special Forces Group. Next to those was a sleeping area, then a living room with a sectional couch, and finally a wooden bar that looked like it had been salvaged out of some small Irish pub.
"Something to drink?" Wise asked, walking around behind the bar.
"What do you have?"
said Harvath, regretting the question almost as soon as he had asked it.
"Whiskey or iced tea?"
"I guess I'll have an iced tea."
"Whiskey it is," said Wise, removing two glasses and setting them atop the bar. "I'm all out of iced tea."
There was a brightly colored oil painting collage of George Washington hanging behind the bar. Harvath thought he recognized the artist.
"That's a Penley, isn't it?"
"It is," the man answered, as he handed Harvath his drink. "Great artist, and an even greater American. I stumbled onto him a few years ago, and now try to get to all of his exhibits."
"A body in motion?" Harvath offered.
"Tends to stay in motion. Words to live by in retirement."
"What exactly is it that you retired from?"
Wise took a sip of his drink.
"The best way I ever heard it described was armed anthropology. I was in the Army for a long time, predominantly the special operations community. The Army put me through undergrad and grad school, where I made the art of killing my focus."
"You mean how soldiers kill?"
"Not just soldiers. Anyone or any organization. Soldiers, law enforcement officers, gang members, contract killers and assassins, psychopaths, nation states, terrorists. You name them, and I studied them."
"Sounds very interesting."
"Fascinating stuff, and I didn't leave a stone unturned. From how our kill rate in combat skyrocketed once the Army switched from bullseye targets to silhouettes, all the way to how and why mass murderers select their victims and places of attack. What I uncovered is that there is a particular mental makeup that excels in combat. Certain aspects of that makeup could be taught so that day-to-day soldiers are more efficient on the battlefield, but there are other aspects that can't be learned. You have to come wired a certain way. As we drilled down and began identifying what those mental markers were, our results began to shape the screening process for certain compartments within the special operations community."
Compartments.
Harvath found the word choice interesting, as if it were something that needed to be contained.
"So the military was looking to select for its most lethal killers."
That was part of it, but as you know, special operations is about a lot more than just killing the enemy. In my case, we were also trying to teach the Army's SF teams what to screen for when they infiltrated foreign countries and worked with insurgent groups. Our Green Berets needed many PhDs that would help them evaluate the potential in the combatants they were supporting. In essence, they needed to be able to rapidly assess if they were helping elevate and train the right people, or if there were better candidates for certain positions. Like I said, I found it to be fascinating work.
The agency must have thought so, too, at some point if you ended up over there, right?
They did, said Wise, taking another sip of his drink. It was at a time when they were experimenting with a lot of interesting programs. They made me an offer that the Army couldn't even come close to matching, so I moved over to Langley.
Where you continued what you'd been doing for the Army?
But with much bigger budgets.
Off book or on? Asked Harbath, referring to where the money had come from for these interesting programs.
But what do you think?
Completely black and off the books, thought Harbath.
Wise's area of expertise was not something the CIA would have likely wanted congressional input on. The politicians would have only watered it down, if not shut it down completely. Members of Congress barely understood the complexities of the military battlefield. What they knew of the intelligence battlefield, you could fit in a shot glass.
Okay, so you're Dr. Kill, armed anthropologist, Harbath continued. Why am I here?
Wise had been called that so many times he'd lost count. Normally it made him smile. This time, though, his face was dead serious. You're here because Reed Carlton thinks I might be able to help with your case.
Can you?
Maybe. But first I want to see how much you know about your victim.
Victims, Harbath replied. Plural.
Wise shook his head. There may be hostages, plural, and a dead body, singular, he said, gently chastising Harbath for correcting him. But the object of all this is a singular victim. And the sooner you understand that, the closer you'll be to solving your case.
Chapter 17. Boston, Massachusetts. He had spent the afternoon taking pictures. He liked taking pictures. He took shots of King's Chapel, the Old North Church, and the Paul Revere House. In the Granary Burying Ground, near the grave of Sam Adams, he found a Gothic-inspired woman with black lipstick and nail polish, who let him photograph her posing provocatively against several of the headstones. After the fourth one, she offered to take him someplace nearby and perform a sex act on him for $50. She was a junkie who wanted to get high. He offered her $10 just to see what she'd say. She told him to fuck himself and flipped him the middle finger as she walked off. She came back 10 minutes later, as he was getting ready to leave, and told him she'd do it for 20. She didn't know it then, but she had been smart to approach him in broad daylight, in an open public space. Had this happened at night, had he been drinking or off his medication, things would have ended much differently. He didn't know what her drug of choice was, or how much it cost, but he removed a dollar bill from his wallet and extended it, telling her to get something to eat.
What, a box of Tic Tacs? She demanded in her Southie accent. Go fuck yourself, she told him again.
She was angry, real angry, and that made him smile. Seeing him smile made her even angrier, and she tried to slap him. The speed with which he caught her wrist and twisted her arm behind her back startled her. She was going to scream, but the man sensed it and twisted her arm even tighter as he drew her against him. It was so painful, all the air rushed from her lungs. Her eyes flicked from side to side for anyone who could help her, but the few people she could see were paying attention only to the historic grave markers. He could smell the fear oozing from her pores and feel the exquisite trembling of her body. There was no telling how many diseases she carried, but he didn't care. He was interested in only one thing from her. Closing his eyes, He listened until he could hear the thumping of her terrified heart as it pounded against the wall of her chest. It sounded like a rabbit running from a wolf. He pulled up on her arm, right to the precipice of breaking it, and then he let her go. She stood for a moment, frozen in place by fear. And then, like the little rabbit she was, she ran away as fast as she could from the big bad wolf. He smiled as he watched her run. Broad daylight, a public space, and commitment to his pills, the trinity that had saved her life that late afternoon in the graveyard, and which had given him an appetite. He was wary about where he should and shouldn't go, should and shouldn't eat. Though he had taken steps to disguise his appearance, there were certain risks that were not to be taken. He walked south to the city's Chinatown neighborhood, where he ate in a small hole-in-the-wall restaurant that couldn't afford matching chairs, much less a CCTV system. The best thing to be said about the food was that it was edible. He gorged himself on fried rice and egg rolls, washing it all down with a syrupy sweet Asian soda he had pulled out of the cooler. Impulse control was something the medication was supposed to help. But when he overloaded on stimuli, the way he had in the graveyard, he found his cravings harder to control. In addition to his eating binge, he also had to contend with the fact that his sexual arousal hadn't dissipated. Smelling the terror on the woman, as well as feeling her fluttering body pressed tightly against his, was a heady combination of sensations, made only more acute by the danger of it all. He was drifting into choppy water and being pulled further and further from shore. He fingered the pillbox in his pocket as he stared over at the cooler with its beer and sodas. If he took more medication, he could become dopey and slip up. But if he didn't take any, and he gave in to one of his nastier impulses, he could also slip up. He felt damned either way, which suddenly brought on an additional sensation, anxiety. He decided to write his own prescription. Walking over to the cooler, he removed two Yangjings, paid the old Chinese woman with the whiskers behind the counter, and sat back down at the table. He drank the first beer in one long swallow. With the second, he took his time and willed himself to relax. It took several minutes, but eventually, the warmth of the alcohol crept into his bloodstream, and he began to feel himself relax. The benefit of the anxiety, if you could call it that, was that it was an arousal killer. His erection had completely gone away. The longer he sat in the restaurant, the more relaxed he became. The more relaxed he became, the more his mind drifted, particularly to what had happened at the graveyard, and he could feel the strings of arousal starting to be tugged. He was being pulled out to sea again. What he needed was some coffee. Finishing off his second beer, he steered his legs out onto the street and into the early evening. Rush hour was already well underway. When he finally found a cafe, it was staffed by wrung-out baristas watching the clock, eager to close up and get home for the evening. He ordered his coffee with a black eye, coffee talk for two shots of espresso. As he had done in the Chinese restaurant, he paid in cash and then exited the establishment. He felt the caffeine hit his system faster than the beer. There was a pep in his step, and he felt a buoyancy of spirit. Everything was going to be okay. He was actually looking forward to his assignment tonight. It was complicated, but not impossible. Every step had been mapped out in perfect detail. It was like making a cake. As long as you followed the recipe, you had nothing to worry about. And he always followed the recipe. The vehicle and his supplies were stored in a dilapidated garage in East Boston. He spent an hour casing the neighborhood and an additional hour surveilling the garage before he approached. The key to the padlock had been sewn into the lining of his jacket. Ripping part of the fabric, he removed it and let himself in, closing and locking the door behind him. He slipped a small flashlight from his backpack and cupped the head so as not to throw too much light. The white panel van was unlocked. Climbing in back, he did a quick assessment. Everything was where it was supposed to be. Opening the lid of the large garbage can, he checked to make sure the final ingredient was in place. Squinting into the beam of his flashlight was a man, bound and gagged, with a 2-day growth of beard. He closed the lid and began to feel very excited as he laid out a blue jumpsuit and stripped off his clothes. Chapter 18. Bethesda, Maryland. General George Johnson, Director of National Intelligence, lived in a modest colonial house near D.C. with his wife and around-the-clock protective detail and a French bulldog named Martin. Despite nearly 2 years of the detail that changed shifts every 8 hours, the dog still went berserk every time someone showed up at the house. For the security-minded, this might have been viewed as a positive. General Johnson, though, saw his wife's dog as a colossal pain in the ass. Even before they had rung the bell, Lydia Ryan and Bob McGee could hear both the dog and the DNI barking from inside the house.
"Damn it, Marty, quiet!" Johnson shouted at the bulldog. "Carol, come get this damn dog!"
A solidly built man in a dark suit opened the door. Behind him, the DNI was trying to corral the little bulldog with his foot in order to prevent him from charging the visitors.
"Sorry about this," Johnson said as he beckoned his guests. "Please, come on in."
"I told you you should have gotten a Rottweiler," McGee said as he stepped inside.
"I've got several already."